We are People Powered Radio in northern Minnesota. Join us at KAXE.org. KAXE's long-awaited public beach map is here. Find your next swimming destination at KAXE.org. And while you're there, you can share your favorite beach with us, and we'll add it to the map. Now for Weekend Edition.
From NPR News in Washington, D.C., this is Weekend Edition. I'm Aisha Roscoe. Good morning. In this hour, we have the latest on whether President Trump will send National Guard troops to cities outside of the nation's capital. And the federal crackdown in D.C. is having a chilling effect on some of the capital's church congregations with large immigrant populations.
How can I say, oh, don't worry, everything is going to be fine, when the truth is that they can be caught anywhere, anyway, any moment.
Plus, a new pop music trend is making secular music that feels like church. It's Sunday, August 24th. News is next.
For KAXE News, I'm Larissa Donovan with the Up North Report. The data center construction boom remains on Minnesota's radar with new environmental protections in place, but two cities face lawsuits with claims they are falling short in getting a read on how much future projects would drain natural resources. The Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy this week took legal action against the cities of Lakeville and North Mankato, arguing local leaders did not follow state law under the environmental review process when advancing projects. Evan Mulholland, staff attorney at the center, says the evaluations left a lot to be desired.
We don't know how much water they're going to use. For energy, we don't know where the energy is going to come from. We don't know whether they're going to have contracts for clean energy, for carbon-free energy or not. All of these things are just missing.
He pointed out the public is also left in the dark about potential noise when equipment is running to store digital data and keep computing machines cool. This spring, state lawmakers extended tax breaks to lure more centers, along with tougher environmental regulations. Advocates said the safeguards are a good step, but not enough. When reached for comment, North Mankato officials say they led an open review process. Data centers are known for massive water consumption and pushing energy demand higher. In some cases, developers request to implement backup diesel generators, potentially adding to their carbon footprint. Mulholland stressed they are not against such facilities, recognizing the need to accommodate digital use in everyday life. He emphasized they are seeking transparency when measuring the environmental impact.
Some of these cities have signed non-disclosure agreements with the developer, and it's becoming an obstacle for the public to understand what it is being proposed to be built.
North Mankato officials said they were looking at different types of development, prompting a broad review without specific details. But the lawsuit contended city staff used the term data center in emails when discussing the matter. The plaintiffs are requesting a stop to project activity, including permitting, until a more detailed environmental assessment is done. It's a burden many Minnesota parents can relate to, struggling to afford childcare or finding an open slot. Now, a decades-old idea to create equal access around the country is getting another look. The U.S. childcare system is often described as broken, with states and local governments pursuing a patchwork of solutions, along with limited federal subsidies for low-income households. The nonprofit think tank, the Roosevelt Institute, led a new report calling for a, quote, public option approach with stronger federal investments to close gaps. Lena Billick, a program manager for the Institute, said despite the urgency, attempts to solve this crisis for working parents have been uneven at best.
We keep tinkering around the edges, but, you know, what we really need is for childcare to be a public
good. The author
good.
Suggested, like public schools, there should be a universal network of care sites to guarantee free slots without means testing. Instead of subsidies and tax credits, they called for a big boost in federal aid for providers so they can expand and hire staff and keep costs down. The policy push traces back to the 1970s, but has faced political resistance along the way. On average, childcare costs account for nearly 19% of a Minnesota family's income. While this idea still has opponents, elected leaders from all parties have filed bipartisan bills in response to the childcare shortage. The Economic Security Project is a partner in the report. Taylor Jo Eisenberg, executive director of the nonprofit Economic Security Project, is among those who see it as an infrastructure investment to help the economy by keeping parents in the workforce.
And so I think understanding these as tools, not just to meet the needs of families right now, but as a kind of foundation of a healthy, dynamic economy and country is a really important part of the story.
Some of the national pushback against a universal system suggests it would erode the quality of care. Billick countered one of their recommendations strongly advises against provisions like deregulation.
A trend around the country is sort of changing adult-to-child ratio rules to deal with the shortage of staff. Now, that might sound okay, but then you picture a room, we're talking literal babies or infants that need care, and you need a lot of adults for that.
Thanks to Minnesota News Connection for these stories. That's it for the Up North Report. From the KAXE News Desk, I'm Larissa Donovan, telling the stories of northern Minnesota through local news.
The Up North Report is made possible by Woodland Bank, serving the area since 1920 with locations in Grand Rapids, Cohasset, Hill City, and Deer River. Woodland Bank believes in building community and serving local nonprofits like KAXE.
In addition from NPR News, I'm Aisha Roscoe. Good morning. There's been no summer slowdown in Washington, D.C. President Trump's takeover of the capital city's police is about to enter its third week. And now the president is threatening to send National Guard troops to other cities. It comes as the FBI searched the home of President Trump's former national security advisor, John Bolton. Joining us to discuss all this is NPR senior White House correspondent Tamara Keith. Good morning.
Good morning.
So let's start with John Bolton. How do you view this development?
Yeah, so he was a first-term national security advisor and has since become a vocal Trump critic, something that Trump complained about recently on social media. And one of Trump's first acts as president was to withdraw Secret Service protection from Bolton. That was protection he had because Iran wants him dead. So that's the context in which this search of Bolton's home took place. Two sources familiar with the investigation who weren't authorized to speak publicly told NPR that the search of Bolton's home and office was tied to his handling of classified documents. During an interview on Friday for NBC's Meet the Press, Vice President J.D. Vance was specifically asked if Bolton was being targeted because he's a critic of President Trump. And Vance insisted he wasn't.
If we bring a case, and of course we haven't done that yet, the Department of Justice has not done that yet. We are investigating Ambassador Bolton, but if they ultimately bring a case, it will be because they determine that he has broken the law.
And I will note, he says we. In any other administration, you wouldn't hear the White House talking about a potential Justice Department criminal case as we, because there's supposed to be a separation. But that just doesn't exist in the Trump administration. Vance brought up the Justice Department prosecutions of Trump and his allies during the Biden administration. The view in MAGA world is that opened Pandora's box, and now all bets are off.
Tam, if you would, can you just give us a little more context? Is this just about John Bolton?
Not even close. Senator Adam Schiff, who led Trump's first impeachment, is being investigated for alleged mortgage fraud. So is Letitia James, the prosecutor in New York, who secured a fraud conviction against Trump when he was out of office. Other outspoken critics of Trump are openly expressing concern that they could be next. During the campaign, President Trump told supporters, "I am your retribution." And many people sounded alarmed. So Trump said, no, don't worry. All he meant was that success would be retribution. It is now clear that in fact, retribution is retribution.
I mean, here in D.C., you do see some National Guard troops patrolling the streets. But now President Trump is talking about sending troops to Chicago. That's drawn a strong response.
Yeah, on Friday in the Oval Office, President Trump suggested that Chicago and New York may be next. Those are both blue cities in blue states. The Washington Post is exclusively reporting that the Pentagon has been drawing up planning documents to deploy troops to Chicago to crack down on crime, homelessness, and undocumented immigration. Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker, as you know, wrote on social media, quote, Donald Trump's threat to bring in the National Guard to Chicago isn't about safety. It's a test of the limits of his power and a trial run for a police state. Illinois has long worked with federal law enforcement to tackle crime, but we won't let a dictator impose his will. Earlier this year, Trump sent troops to Los Angeles against the wishes of the governor and the mayor. And the question of whether he was allowed to do that is still being litigated.
And I gather there was a surprise on Friday during an event about next year's soccer World Cup draw. President Trump held a photo that someone had sent him.
Yes, that's right. And that someone was Russian President Vladimir Putin. Take a listen to how it all unfolded.
He's been very respectful of me and of our country, but not so respectful of others. But he'll I'm going to sign this for him. But I was sent one and I thought you'd all like to see it. That's a man named Vladimir Putin.
Which is remarkable. There was the president of the United States in the Oval Office proudly holding up a picture of himself with a Russian dictator with a portrait of Ronald Reagan looming over his shoulder. This despite no signs of progress in Trump's quest to secure peace in Russia's war against Ukraine. Trump said on Friday that sanctions could be back on the table and that he'd know more in 2 weeks.
That's NPR senior White House correspondent Tamara Keith. Thank you for joining us.
You're welcome.
Ukraine is marking its Independence Day. The country's president, Volodymyr Zelensky, gave a speech today reminding fellow Ukrainians that we're fighting for freedom. But there's little to cheer. Joining us now to discuss the recent diplomatic push is Yaroslav Trofimov. He's the chief foreign affairs correspondent of the Wall Street Journal. He's also the author of No Country for Love, a novel set in 1930s Ukraine. Welcome to the program.
Great to be on the show.
So let's start with Russia. Like, how will it view this moment?
Well, you know, Russia wanted to extinguish Ukraine's independence. That was the primary goal of the invasion 3.5 years ago in February 2022. And look at it now. There are no Ukrainian tanks in Kiev. There are foreign dignitaries, including the Canadian Prime Minister, visiting the Ukrainian capital today. And all of Russia's efforts to support Ukraine have not been successful. You know, Russia has lost hundreds of thousands of soldiers over the past nearly 3 years since November 2022, and for all that effort, managed to advance by less than 1% of Ukrainian territory. So I think Ukrainians have a reason to celebrate today that their independence is safeguarded. Maybe not the entire land of Ukraine, but still 80% of Ukraine is free.
But the war is dragging on, and we heard from Russia's top diplomat on Friday that no meeting is planned between President Putin and his Ukrainian counterpart. What do you think the chances are that there will ever be a meeting between these two men?
Well, I think chances are pretty slim right now because President Putin of Russia thinks he can win this war, and he operates in a different time frame. He has this messianic vision of being the gatherer of Russian lands. And if you remember, this war began with him writing a historical essay on how the Ukrainians are really Russians and they do not deserve a separate future. And so I think his mission in life, as he sees it, is to bring Ukraine back into the fold of Russia and extinguish Ukrainian statehood. And that is the reason why the Ukrainians are resisting so hard today. You know, I wrote in my novel about the famine that killed millions of Ukrainians in the 1930s and the sort of wholesale elimination of the Ukrainian elites by the Soviet regime at the time. It's a story that is a story of so many Ukrainian families. Well, the Ukrainians today all have grandmothers or grandfathers like me who went through the same experience, and they know that surrender to Russia is worse than whatever sacrifice they have to make today to keep fighting Russia.
But I guess
so surrender isn't an option.
But when you look at, you know, how to actually bring this war to a close or what's going to happen next, you know, President Trump is renewing a threat to impose sanctions on Russia if there's no progress in making a peace deal. But sanctions have been imposed before. Like, what would it actually take for Putin to change course on Ukraine?
Well, you know, there are two wars going on. There is a war on the battlefield, which is a stalemate, more or less. Russia is advancing very slowly. And then there is the air war. And Ukraine, for example, has been hitting harder and harder at the Russian oil and gas infrastructure, which is the lifeline for the Russian economy. And that oil and gas revenue is what allows Russia to keep recruiting soldiers for the war. President Trump also has already imposed sanctions on India, for buying Russian oil. You know, India buys about, you know, almost 40% of Russian oil exports. So strangling this source of revenue could actually change the cost-benefit analysis in Moscow and create constraints for the Russian war machine.
What do you think the U.S. is willing to do that sort of pressure?
Well, I mean, there is already a concrete step with India. Now, will President Trump go any further? You know, he changes his mind on this war very regularly, and so far this threats of making big decisions in 2 weeks have been repeated and then pulled back. It's clear that the meeting in Alaska was a big victory for President Putin because he succeeded in removing this threat of sanctions and removing also President Trump's demand for an immediate ceasefire.
Well, I mean, do you think it's feasible for Ukraine to keep fighting this war without meaningful American support?
Well, there is a European support. The Europeans now account for the majority of support for Ukraine. And the Europeans are also going to be buying American weapons that cannot be produced in Ukraine. Is it feasible? I mean, the question is, what is the alternative? If the alternative is a surrender, which is what President Putin is demanding, essentially, because the Russian demands, as voiced by Foreign Minister Lavrov in recent days, are very similar to what they were back when the war began, basically. A Ukraine that is unable to defend itself, a Ukraine that does not have any security guarantees, and a Ukraine that surrenders large parts of its territory. So this surrender is not acceptable to Ukrainians because they know from their bitter history in the past, the history that it's, you know, my book talks about, that you know, there will be more death and more killing and more destruction if they accept to be under Russian rule again.
What do you see any breakthrough to end this war in the coming weeks? Do you think that's possible?
I think it's highly unlikely that there will be any breakthrough in the coming weeks because the Russians still think they can win it. And the President Putin thinks he can outlast the will of the West. And obviously now that American support for Ukraine is much reduced compared to what it was under President Biden, he thinks he can gain the upper hand in the battlefield. And eventually the front line will crumble and Ukraine will collapse. And the Ukrainians, with the help of the Europeans, are doing everything they can to prevent this sort of catastrophic outcome.
That's Yaroslav Trofimov of the Wall Street Journal. Thank you so much for joining us.
Great to be there.
You're listening to NPR News.
You are tuned in to Weekend Edition here on member-supported KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. Northern Khmer Radio's Board of Directors meets at 6 p.m. Monday, August 25th at KBXE in Bemidji. This is an open meeting. Members and the general public are invited to attend. For more information, email comments at kaxe.org or call 218-326-1234 during business hours. Regular meetings of our Board of Directors are held the fourth Monday of the month. The board's meeting schedule is available at kaxe.org. The Minnesota Board of Water and Soil Resources offers the Lawn to Legumes program, which aims to increase habitat for at-risk pollinators in residential settings. The deadline to apply for the 2026 season is November 30th. Find more info and apply at bluethumb.org. Now we'll take you back to Weekend Edition here on member-supported KAXE KBXE.
Kyle Snyder with these headlines. Illinois Democratic Governor J.B. Pritzker says President Trump is attempting to manufacture a crisis. He issued a statement after the Washington Post reported this weekend that the Pentagon has been planning a military deployment to Chicago as part of a crackdown on crime. He has already deployed National Guard in the nation's capital. Fire crews in Northern California have been working this weekend to corral the Pickett Fire in Napa County. It's burned more than 6,000 acres and led to evacuations in rural communities. And the Little League World Series title game is today in South Williamsport, Pennsylvania. Taiwan set to play the Las Vegas team, which is looking for Nevada's first championship. I'm Giles Snyder, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from the NPR Wine Club, now shipping to additional states. Whether purchasing a few wines or joining the wine club, every purchase supports NPR. Available to adults 21 or older. NPRWineClub.org. From Capital One, offering their premium travel card, Venture X. What's in your wallet? Terms apply. Details at CapitalOne.com. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
This is Week in Edition from NPR News. I'm Aisha Roscoe. Tomorrow marks 2 weeks since President Trump issued an executive order declaring a crime emergency in the District of Columbia, and houses of worship here are feeling a chilling effect. Last weekend, churches in neighborhoods with large numbers of immigrants reported drops in attendance. Now, many of them are facing another Sunday of uncertainty. To help us understand this, I'm joined by Aleha Hertzler-McCain from our partners at Religion News Service. Welcome to the program.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
A lot of church leaders have said this is already impacting their congregations. Can you tell us a bit about what happened last Sunday?
It was a bit of a mixed bag. In some churches with many immigrants, leaders told me attendance was pretty normal, but several other faith leaders said attendance was significantly down. One pastor told me that the church's WhatsApp groups were full of sightings of agents and immigration detentions and just a lot of fear. And that fear even extends to citizens and people with legal status because they say they're afraid of racial profiling. And some people say this kind of feels like the beginning of the COVID-19 pandemic with people stockpiling food and hiding at home. One Episcopal church even canceled their service last week.
For those congregations who really are feeling an effect, what's it been like for people in the pews? Has that fear changed things for them?
Yeah, in one Catholic parish with a large Central American population, but also people from other parts of the world, the Shrine of the Sacred Heart, the pastor told me mass attendance was down about 20%. That's 500 fewer people than normal. And one usher originally from Guatemala was detained just 3 blocks from the parish while walking to mass last Sunday. And he's not the only one. The pastor told me at one point this week there were 7 parishioners in detention, some of them detained coming to and from church. There's also fear in the parish in other ways. One woman went in to pick up her final check at a job she's too scared to go to this week, and lay leader Sonia Aquino went with her. Here's what she had to say.
How can I say, don't worry, everything is going to be fine, when the truth is that it's not that way? They can be caught anywhere, anyway, any moment.
Aquino said for some people this is shaking their faith, but she encourages them to remain strong.
I mean, this really sounds like a very challenging moment for the pastors and the church leaders who are trying to minister to congregants in crisis. How have they been handling this?
There's some really intense emotions right now. Congregation Action Network's executive director, Reverend Julio Hernandez, told me this.
The grief is unbearable. The lament that we feel as a community, I feel like we are losing our humanity in this moment.
Reverend Hernandez told me some people are terrified because their loved ones are disappearing and they can't even find them in the government locator for detention. And those feelings have a physical impact. Some people can't sleep or rest.
So how are churches navigating this Sunday's services?
Yeah, the churches I spoke to told me they're committed to meeting the needs of their members, whether they can make it to the building or not. That Catholic church I mentioned earlier is committed to moving forward with activities, you know, like a health fair today, because people who come in person still need services. Other faith leaders told me that they're making sure that people who are stuck at home get food. They're walking the streets to try to make other people feel more safe. They're setting up prayer vigils, and they're also ensuring or working to ensure that people in detention receive pastoral care, which isn't always possible.
That's Aleha Hertzler-McCain from Religion News Service. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
This story was produced through a collaboration between NPR and Religion News Service. The Trump administration did not offer comment on this report, but has consistently said that its immigration enforcement actions are necessary and long overdue. The official White House newsletter last week posted an article titled "President Trump is Right About the Smithsonian." It called out some of the work shown at the National Museum of African American History and Culture, the National Museum of the American Latino, and other institutions as objectionable art. NPR's Mandalit Del Barco spoke to some of the artists and scholars mentioned on the list.
The White House highlighted some Smithsonian artwork, exhibitions, and programs that focus on race, slavery, immigration, and sexuality, work that was first written about in the conservative online magazine The Federalist. Last week, 8 of the Smithsonian museums were given 120 days to submit their current and future plans for a comprehensive review to bring the Smithsonian in line with President Trump's cultural directives. Writer and scholar Ibram X. Kendi says he's not surprised to be targeted by the White House, which called him a, quote, woke activist.
They've been trying to discredit me and my work, and it's because they don't want white people and others to actually read my work.
Kendi is a professor at Howard University and author of the book How to Be an Anti-Racist. It's featured on the website of the National Museum of African American History and Culture. Kendi says in his writing, he guides people how to deconstruct racism, unlearn racist ideas, and recognize racial equality.
That type of transformation and learning is in direct conflict to an administration that's trying to convince particularly white Americans that they are under attack, or that they are being harmed, or that racism doesn't exist, or they're the primary subject of racism.
NPR reached out to the White House asking for comment about the article highlighting the Smithsonian artists. They have not responded. But one artist, Hugo Crosswaite, said he was shocked but pleased to see his name on the list.
I was kind of honored, you know, to be included in a list of great art pieces celebrating diversity.
In 2022, the Smithsonian's National Portrait Gallery commissioned Crosswaite to create a study of Dr. Anthony Fauci, former director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases and chief medical advisor to President Biden.
He's a very humble man. He didn't want the idea of a painting of him, I don't know, with a big shield fighting a virus, you know, something like that. But then I came with this idea of, well, you know, I could do this stop motion animation that basically tells the narrative of his career, you know.
In a video, Crosswaite animated 19 drawings depicting Fauci helping create vaccines during the HIV/AIDS crisis and the COVID-19 pandemic.
It kind of seems like they just came up with the idea, oh, this is about Fauci, so then we hate it. And they probably haven't even seen it.
Still, Crosswaite says the attention he and the other artists are getting now isn't all negative.
They're trying to censor artwork, but it always kind of backfires. It usually draws more attention to these art pieces, which I think is wonderful.
On the White House list is a dance performance at the National Portrait Gallery from 2022. It illustrates two immigrants crossing the U.S.-Mexico border. That was also the theme of a painting by Texas artist Rigoberto Gonzalez.
At first, I was a little shocked, but then I was a little bit glad. You know, my work is political, and that painting in particular was questioning the anti-immigrant sentiment of the time.
His painting, Refugees Crossing the Border Wall into South Texas, was a competition finalist for the National Portrait Gallery in 2000. It's now in a private collection. Gonzalez was born in Mexico and is a U.S. citizen. He says being named on the White House list is an attempt to harass him, but he's unfazed.
The raids, they were having the ICE raids. I'm thinking of making a painting based on those rates, because groups of people chasing other members of society and wrestling them down, it lends itself perfectly for my aesthetic, which is like a Baroque Renaissance aesthetic, very dynamic. So I'm already thinking of ways to paint it.
But the thought of being named by the White House is daunting for other artists.
I'm terrified, absolutely.
That's Brooklyn-based artist Patricia Cronin. Her bronze sculpture, Memorial to a Marriage, is part of the National Portrait Gallery's permanent collection. It depicts herself and her now wife embracing on a bed. It's a monument to marriage equality.
Because of the LGBTQ plus subject matter, it would fall under being deemed un-American. So what are they going to do, melt it down?
Cronin says going after the Smithsonian could end up silencing other museums and galleries, and artists may begin censoring themselves.
I really shudder to think how much of the American story is going to be lost, because some of it won't even get created.
Mandalit del Barco, NPR News.
A new generation of musicians is nodding toward the church in pop music.
They say the holy water's watered down, and this town's lost its faith. Our colors will fade.
The singer Alex Warren is one of the artists behind this trend, which Yahoo News reporter Kelsey Weekman calls secular praise music.
I noticed these songs, they really praised someone. They use very dramatic language to really build someone up into this anthemic chorus that's usually really easy to memorize. It's really fun to belt. But it sounded a lot to me like what you might hear if you go to church and you stand with the congregation and listen to music. It just has the same kind of flow and emphasis on lyrics.
Songs are really popular. Is this also like just what pop music sounds like now?
Honestly, I think a big part of the reason why this particular music is doing so well is not only because it's easy to listen to on the radio, but because people are using it a lot on social media when they're posting about big life moments, very emotional things that are going on. So people associate the songs with really positive things, and that makes the genre as a whole really popular right now.
Talk us through a couple of the big artists who you've seen in this kind of secular praise music genre.
Yeah, Alex Warren was the one who I noticed and realized I really couldn't deny this trend anymore. He sings these gorgeous love songs about his wife that use terms like angels, hallelujah, heaven. Another artist is Teddy Swims. He has a song called Lose Control that has been on the Billboard Hot 100 for 2 full years. It really declares a lot of love and passion for someone. It just sounds just like a worship song. You could play it on a loudspeaker in mixed company and not have to answer too many questions.
Just like music, a lot of times, the church is also can be very segregated by race in the U.S. You got the black church, and then you got the white churches, and the music's different and things like that. How diverse is the secular praise music genre?
It's quite honestly very white. It does take a lot from mega churches, which are frequently white. And I would say that if you were going to talk about secular gospel music, you would be able to include more diverse artists.
This isn't new, the mixing of like church elements and popular music, you know, because you have people like Ray Charles and Aretha Franklin and Sam Cooke who also sang gospel music and obviously brought a lot of that into the music that they made that was secular.
Totally. And I talked to a source who cited Earth, Wind & Fire and Boyz II Men as these gospel-inspired but still secular artists who brought in more of like a gospel element than just a classic mega church guitar song, like what I'm referring to as worship music that's been secularized.
For a while there it was rough, but lately I've been doing better than the last four cold Decembers I recall.
Do you have a song in this genre of this kind of secular praise music that you can't stop listening to?
I will be so honest with you. I love Benson Boone. I know he has a background of being raised as a Mormon. He is a great lyricist, and he really has that showmanship that is also kind of popular at megachurches these days, but sets him apart in kind of the pop side of things.
I found my mind, I'm feeling sane. It's been a while, but I'm finding my faith. If everything is good,
that's Kelsey Weekman. She's a culture reporter for Yahoo News. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
I've got enough. I've got peace and I've got love. But I'm up and I'm thinking I just might lose it all.
You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News. It's sometimes called the Cape Cod of the Midwest. Wisconsin's Door County is a popular tourism spot on the shores of Lake Michigan. But for many locals, the biggest attraction is the county's baseball league. WUWM's Susan Bentz brings us along to the final game of the regular season.
The Door County Baseball League has been around for more than a century. There are eight teams. Two of the biggest rivals are the Washington Islanders and the Sister Bay Bays. On this day, a dozen Bays are out on the field tossing balls, getting ready for the end of the season. Griffin Cole covers second base.
We kind of focus on ourselves more than anything, just hitting, and it's fun and we're winning.
There's some basis for Cole's confidence. Sister Bay has come out on top seven of the last 10 seasons. Getting to the stadium for the game today means taking the ferry to Washington Island, so the players drive their trucks full of bats, balls, and equipment on board. The Bay's youngest member is excited. Hobbs Emerson is about to start his sophomore year in high school. His dad recently retired from the team.
Yeah, I mean, it's fun because they all know me since I was a baby and all that, so kind of being the next upcoming guy, it's just fun to be with all of them and learn how to actually play a good ball.
At the ballpark, lifelong Islanders fan Shannon Young is waiting. She always sits at the same spot behind first base.
My dad played. He started playing in 1967, so he was a sophomore in high school. I was coming to games since my mom's womb. He was coach for a while, and so coming up to practice and games was just like my thing.
Troy Jorgensen has been with the Islanders for 22 seasons and says half the players on the team are his cousins. Andy says the entire island has been looking forward to this game for weeks.
It's just a great atmosphere. We got really great fans. People up here, they live for baseball. This is like the one thing they look forward to in the summertime.
Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to the ball game. We've got an exciting matchup for you today between the Sister Bay Bays and your Washington Island Islanders.
The Bays are up first.
Now up for the Bays, Tom Sawyer.
Go, Tommy!
Tom Sawyer is one of Sister Bay's top players. Sawyer hit a single. But the Islanders' Ryan Jorgensen, Troy Jorgensen's 21-year-old cousin, was the star of the game. A plumber when he's not playing baseball, Jorgensen threw an astounding 150 pitches. And the final score, the Islanders 2, the Bays 1. Islander fan Peter Corden was practically speechless. He coached Ryan Jorgensen when he was a teenager.
This is one of the most natural players I have ever seen. He just had all this natural ability. And he comes from a line of great. I'm sure in the history of this league, there's probably never not been a Jorgensen in the lineup. So this is great for him.
And although Sister Bay lost the game, their fun isn't over. Their season record means they made it into the playoffs. So for the team and Door County locals who love the game, there's still more baseball to come. For NPR News, I'm Susan Bentz on Washington Island.
This is NPR News.
You're listening to Weekend Edition on this Sunday morning here on member-supported KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. We receive support from Grand Rapids Arts, connecting artists and audience, encouraging creativity and collaboration through monthly First Friday art walks and more. Information is available at grandrapidsarts.org. Thanks to our listeners, we've raised over $160,000 during this crisis caused by federal cuts to public media. KAXE is working hard to keep the programming you love going strong. Every action helps. Donate, share our work, or buy a ticket to Grand Rapids Riverfest. Visit KAXE.org. Brainerd Women of Today invite all ages to Chalk the Block Monday, August 25th from 9:30 to 11 a.m. Spread positivity by drawing or writing uplifting messages on Laurel Street. Meet at Passport Restaurant. Now back to Weekend Edition.
I'm Joel Snyder with these headlines. Russia is accusing Ukraine of launching drone attacks overnight that targeted several Russian power facilities, leading to a fire at a nuclear plant in the western Kursk region, close to the Ukrainian border. The attacks came as Ukraine marks its Independence Day today. State media in North Korea say leader Kim Jong-un has supervised a test firing of two types of new air defense missiles. The launches were carried out this weekend, coinciding with South Korean President Lee Jae-myung summit with Japan's prime minister. Lee is to meet with President Trump in Washington tomorrow. And SpaceX is set to launch another test flight of its huge Starship rocket. Liftoff is scheduled for this evening at the private company's Starbase headquarters in South Texas. I'm Joel Snyder, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Americans United for Separation of Church and State. Since 1946, AU has supported the First Amendment right of freedom of religion. More at AU.org. From Progressive Insurance, where drivers can compare direct rates using Progressive's rate comparison tool. Customers can see options and rates side by side. More at Progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. And from the sustaining members of this NPR station.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Aisha Roscoe, and it's time to play the puzzle. Joining us this week is Will Shortz. He's puzzle editor of the New York Times and puzzle master of Weekend Edition. How's it going, Will?
Excellent. How are you doing, Aisha?
I'm doing good, but I have a little cold, so I couldn't do my puzzle master the way I used. You see that? It's a little rough, but I'm doing good. Would you please remind us of last week's challenge?
Yes, it was an amazing anagram from Ed Pegg Jr. And I said take the classic illustrated children's book, Sylvester and the Magic Pebble. It was by William Steig, and it won the Caldecott Medal in 1970. I said rearrange its 26 letters to name a famous film director and a noted role on stage. Well, the film director is Steven Spielberg, and that role is Lady Macbeth.
There were nearly 900 correct entries, and this week's winner is Sarah Garber of Cornelius, North Carolina. Congratulations, Sarah.
Thank you so much.
How did you figure out this week's answer?
Well, my husband and I always listen to it together, and then we kind of try to figure it out separately to try to beat each other. And I just had a gut feeling that it had to be a Shakespeare role because there's nothing more iconic. And so I just started writing down Shakespeare roles, and then my husband was saying film directors out loud, and I was writing those down, and I just went, you know, I just feel like Macbeth sounds right.
Okay, well, that is amazing. How long have you been playing the puzzle?
It's been about 10 years that I've been listening every week and that we've been listening together.
So you came up with it this time. You beat the husband.
I did. And I said, ha-ha.
Yeah, exactly. So what do you do when you're not playing the puzzle?
Well, I was a chemist for 10 years, and now I am taking a hiatus to raise our daughter, who is 2. We really love to work with the library, and I was recently added to our library's committee for their endowment.
Oh, that's so nice.
Thank you.
I gotta ask you, are you ready to play the puzzle?
I hope so, but with your help, definitely.
Yes, you are ready. All right, take it away, Will.
All right, Sarah and Aisha, every answer today is a familiar three-word phrase in which the middle word is of. The first word starts with S, and the last word starts with L. For example, if I said university or other site of higher education, you would say seat of learning. So it's always S of L. Here's your first one, a site welcoming immigrants in New York Harbor.
Statue of Liberty.
That's it. Something good that happens to you by chance.
Something good that happens to you by chance. Stroke of luck.
That's right. The cabinet official who oversees the collection of data on the economy and the workforce.
Secretary of...
Yes.
Labor.
That's it. Good job. How about social phenomenon in San Francisco during June, July, and August of 1967?
Season of love.
Well...
Summer of love.
Summer of love, is it? Good.
Yes.
Collection you might buy from the brand Samsonite, Toomey, or American Tourister?
Samsonite collection.
You know what those are brands of?
I have no idea. Oh, I've heard of Samsonite, but I couldn't tell you what
Samsonite,
they...
Samsonite, like, well, you use them at the airport?
That's right.
Oh, luggage.
Yes, and you want a collection of them.
Set of luggage?
A set of luggage is it. Good job.
Ooh, that one was hard.
You put the pieces together, though. Classic 1945 film sequel centered around the offspring of a beloved collie.
Sons of Lassie? Son of Lassie.
Son of Lassie, is it? Good job. And here's your last one. A law that sets a time limit for filing a lawsuit.
Oh, I should know this.
So what's the synonym for law that starts with S?
Oh, I get it now.
I have no idea.
Oh, my goodness. It just hit me.
And after a while, you can't do it anymore.
Statute of limitations.
You got it. Good job. It came through in the end.
Woo!
Yeah, that last one was trickier, but you did a great job with all of them. You were getting them. So how do you feel?
I feel like everyone says this, but I am relieved.
For playing our puzzle today, you'll get a weekend edition lapel pin as well as puzzle books and games. You can read all about it at npr.org/puzzle. And Sarah, what member station do you listen to?
WFAE in Charlotte.
That's Sarah Garber of Cornelius, North Carolina. Thank you so much for playing the puzzle.
Thank you, Will. Thank you, Aisha.
Okay, Will, what's next week's challenge?
Yes, it comes from Bobby Jacobs of Glen Allen, Virginia. Take the first and last names of a famous athlete, change the first letter of the last name to L, and rearrange the result to get the first and last names of another famous athlete. And in each case, the first name has 6 letters and the last name has 5. I'll tell you, these are athletes that everybody knows. So again, famous athlete, change the first letter of the last name to L and anagram the result, and you'll get another famous athlete. Both ones are 6 letters first name, 5 letter last name. Which athletes are these?
You have your assignment, puzzlers. When you have the answer, go to our website, npr.org/puzzle. To submit your response, just fill out the form on the puzzle page. Remember, just one entry, please. Our deadline for entries this week is Thursday, August 28th at 3 p.m. Eastern. Don't forget to include a phone number where we can reach you. If you're the winner, we'll give you a call. And if you pick up the phone, you'll get to play on the air with the puzzle editor of the New York Times and puzzle master of Weekend Edition, Will Shorts. Thank you, Will.
Thank you, Aisha.
Weighted vests are the latest trend among fitness influencers, especially on TikTok.
Your posture, your bones, increased calorie burn, your strength, your endurance. Like, I could go on and on and on.
But do they actually help, or are they just the latest fitness fad? Tomorrow on Morning Edition, listen on your radio or by telling your smart speaker to play NPR or your member station by name. Ruth doesn't fit in, and the entire point of her insular religious community is to fit in. Ruth tells jokes. Ruth has ideas. She reads everything she can get her hands on, but those choices are pretty limited.
It took Ruth trial and mortifying error to learn what of the Bible was now accurate only in metaphor. Ethiopians, Jews, and Greeks still existed. Pharisees, Samaritans, and barbarians did not. Magi still existed as Persians. Leprosy still existed. Pharaohs did not. At Saracens, Moors, and eunuchs, Ruth wondered. Not to mention all that the Bible didn't. China, India, America, outer space. The library's encyclopedias, clear and sedative beside the Bible's cryptic thrills, still misled. Ruth lived for decades in an alternate reality containing Zanzibar and dipsomania.
Ruth is the main character and the title of a new novel by Kate Riley, who joins us now. Welcome to the program.
Thank you so much.
Tell us about this community that Ruth is born into. What do they believe?
So there, the community is in the Peace Church tradition, which would be the Amish, the Friends. It's a group that came from Europe. They were persecuted by the Catholics because they didn't believe in infant baptism. They thought that everybody who wanted to be a Christian should make that decision as an adult. That was a hot take.
Back in the day, it's a big deal, yeah.
So they don't have any private property. They share everything in common. They don't have any official hierarchy. Like, you come to decision through consensus and prayer. It's sort of like being in summer camp your whole life.
When you
get to share all your appliances, or have to share all your appliances with your closest neighbors, you don't have quite as much to worry about, except you got a lot more, like, community negotiation to do to make sure people are getting what they want when they want it.
What is it like for Ruth in particular? Because, as we said, she is very curious. She is kind of questioning. She has a lot of thoughts. She's trying to figure things out.
It is, in a lot of ways, based on my experience in a community like that. And I'm a very inquisitive person, like, often to my detriment, but, like, just wanting to know how things work, wanting to know what's going on outside and inside, and not knowing whether that curiosity is itself kind of a bad thing. Like, should I just be content with the information I'm given? Because a lot of people seem really good with that. Like, that seems to satisfy a lot of people. And what's wrong with me that I want to know everything about everything?
Mm-hmm.
That was something that I felt constantly, and I didn't grow up in a community like that. I had the information of, you know, growing up in New York City and like, having access to all sorts of internet, but I wanted to, like, explore what it would be like if you didn't come from a place of total access, but had that same drive to, like, see the world and know what people were thinking and know what the rules were in other places, or why the rules were the rules. Like, all that stuff is so interesting to me.
I hate to do this to an author, because it's not that Ruth is you, but is Ruth kind of your exploration of some of your own thoughts?
Yeah. I mean, it's real weird to know that basically a slice of my brain is now being sold as fiction. Yeah, a lot of her interior life is based on my own and my own, you know, worries about being bad, or worries about why do I feel different, or why is something that seems so easy for other people really tough for me? But I think I definitely was not the only person struggling with any of those questions there.
What happened there? Or how did you end up in joining the community, and how long did you stay, and all of that?
It was the kind of thing where I was preoccupied with being a good person, and I studied philosophy in college, and I did not find any answers or any that, like, seemed to track in real life. And when I met the kids from this community, to see people who seemed so sincerely, like, kind and thoughtful and hardworking in a way that I couldn't twist into, well, they were just naive or they were just deluded. Like, they were smart and engaged. And it was like the first time I'd seen a group of young people specifically who seemed to be able to both, like, talk and act on moral beliefs. But they just happened to exist in this weird cloistered place that the only way to learn about it is to go there and do it. I can't get this information remotely. I have to go and try it for myself.
So you tried it. How long were you there?
I mean, all told, about a year of living in that community and then time beforehand sort of visiting or trying for shorter times. And it was some of the happiest time of my life.
Why did you choose to write this novel, like, as a series of glimpses into Ruth's life over the years, like these vignettes?
Well, one, it's a real easy way for me to write. I can't hold big thoughts in my brain. So it's nice to just have, like, to focus on a moment or a memory. There are two books by a writer named Evan S. Cannell that are Mrs. Bridge and Mr. Bridge, and they are biographies basically of his parents, but they're told in the same way. And the first time I read them in high school, I was like, oh, this is... He figured it out. Like, this is the best way to tell anybody's story. Because that's all... Like, my experience of being a human, like, you're not having these sort of sweeping thoughts about your own narrative. You're just moving through the day. You're, like, you know, having a weird interaction on the subway and then sort of getting lost in thought, looking out the window. And so telling a story in just those actual moments gives you a much better sense of what this person is like day to day. I like specifics. I like lists of nouns. I like particular moments and feelings and phrases, and that was why I chose to do it that way.
This community in the book, mm-hmm. I think some people reading it, and I was reading it too, like, is someone going to come out? Is there going to be an abuse scandal?
Yeah,
is it going to
yeah,
be
yeah.
some, you know, violence or mm-hmm. abuse? That's not there. It's very mm-hmm. gentle, mundane. But it does seem like with Ruth in that community, it's not that she is harmed, but Ruth doesn't seem all that happy. Does that matter, the personal happiness of Ruth?
I think I, aside from the time when I lived in that community, I have basically been told, like, do what makes you happy. Like, that is the, like, resounding message that I've grown up with, is, like, your happiness is of prime importance, and whatever you need to do to find it is, like, the right thing to do. And I've still been kind of grumpy a lot of, like, grumpy as euphemism. Like, I've been very unhappy at times in my life. And when I was living there, something that I heard from, like, lifetime members, something that I saw and something I absolutely believe is, like, no particular lifestyle is ever going to spare you the basic difficulty of being a human being. Like, nothing, like,
of that, existing, because it is hard to exist.
Like, as long as you love things in the world, you are going to be hurt in the world. And no marriage is easy. No relationship with your children is 100% good, no matter where you are. And there are definitely systems that I think make it more humane or more fair. But I think a lot of the things that that character and I struggle with are things that would be struggles as long as you are conscious. I mean, yeah, that, like, that's about having a brain rather than where that brain happens to be.
On the book jacket, under your mm-hmm. author photo, it says mm-hmm. this is your last book. Mm-hmm. Why?
I gotta set the bar real low, Aisha. It is so nerve-wracking to me that anyone would expect more. So if I manage to achieve anything after this, it will be a nice surprise.
That's a way to look at it. Kate Riley, author of Ruth, her first, but maybe not her last book. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much, Aisha.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Aisha Roscoe.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Subaru, who, along with its retailers, is partnering with AdoptAClassroom.org to provide funding to high-need schools and local communities for the Subaru Loves Learning Initiative. Subaru, more than a car company. And from Raymond James, a firm focused on transforming lives, businesses, and communities through tailored wealth management, banking, and capital market solutions. Disclosures at RaymondJames.com. This is NPR.
You are listening to 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids and 90.5 KBXE Bagley Bemidji. We are Northern Community Radio, telling the stories of the people and land of Northern Minnesota through music, news, conversation, and events. Operating translator K210DR in Brainerd at 89.9. Listen at KAXE.org or on your smart speaker. We need people like you to support this local media. Text word donate to 218-326-1234. Thank you. The Itasca County Family YMCA will be closed for plumbing work August 25th through the 27th. The outdoor courts will still be available. Applications are now open for the University of Minnesota Extension Master Gardener Volunteer Program. Learn how to share science-based horticulture knowledge with people in your area. The course begins in January, and the deadline to apply is on October 1st. To learn more, visit z.umn.edu or contact your local extension office. On the River is our volunteer-hosted mix of folk, rock, jazz, blues, and world music.